Welcome to the Global Gaming Business Podcast, where you hear about the business of the casino entertainment industry from the people who make it happen. I'm Roger Gross, the publisher of GGB, and this week we feature a group interview with the principals of Global Market Advisors, Andrew Klebanow, Steve Galloway, and Bill Brayson, talking about the things that their company has addressed in 2015 and will continue to examine in 2016. Andrew Klebanow, Steve Galloway, and Bill Brayson make up the core of Global Market Advisors. They have vast experience in the casino industry, so when they bring the focus to an issue, they can drill down and get to the bottom of the problem. In 2015, several articles in GGB Magazine have raised the awareness in the industry of the steadily rising hold percentage on the slot floor and what impact that has on players and operators. They also penned expert articles on how free play is actually detrimental to operators. And finally, their long experience in Asia has made GMA the go-to company to hire when you're considering investment in any Asian country, especially Korea, Taiwan, Russia, Vietnam, and Cambodia. They spoke with me at G2E in Las Vegas in October. Bill Brayson, Steve Galloway, and Andrew Klebanow, thanks for joining us on the GGB podcast. You guys make up Global Market Advisors, I think one of the most progressive consulting firms in the business, and you go from foreign lands to issues within the industry. And one of the things that you did for us in the last year was kind of bring to light the kind of struggle between the manufacturers and the operators on payback percentage. I think that really woke a lot of people's eyes, woke them up, opened their eyes to what's happening there. Steve Galloway, why don't you start and give us a little quick capsule of what you guys wrote about, and then we'll talk about
it. Sure. It really started with what I saw happening in Colorado probably 5-6 years ago, where revenue was increasing, but when you looked at the coin in, that was actually going down. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the precursor to what we saw going forward. Then as we started to see regional revenue continuing to decline, despite an improving economy, really started having to ask why. Mm-hmm. And also we just feel from talking to operators and talking to our clients and understanding that the customer isn't as happy as they once were. They don't feel the sense of winning. And then we started looking at relationships between what was happening with revenues in the states that were declining and what was happening with slot hold. Mm-hmm. And we found that as revenue is going down, slot hold is going directly up. Mm-hmm. And the one state we found at the time when we did this about a year ago, that where that didn't occur was in Florida, where revenue was increasing, but at the same time the slot hold was staying flat or going down. Mm-hmm. And just from talking from anecdotal stories and from looking at empirical data, you can see a direct relationship or an inverse relationship between the direction that slot hold is going and the direction that revenue is going.
Right. Now, Andrew, there's accusations on both sides. The operators tell the manufacturers you're not developing interesting enough games. The manufacturers say, no, you're putting the hold percentage too high, so the people run out of money. They can't play the interesting parts of our game because they're out of money too quickly. Do you agree with either side there, or
no? I don't agree with either side.
Okay.
It followed to what Steve was saying. In addition to looking at it quantitatively, we talked to a lot of casino customers. We have a focus group facility here in Las Vegas. I travel around the country and conduct blue ribbon panels around the world, actually. And the consistent message that we always hear is, the slots keep getting tighter. Now, of course, that could be anecdotal. That could just be customers complaining. But once you start looking at the data, it shows that increasingly we've increased the slot hold, not what the recent study that applied analysis produced, but we're seeing far dramatic increases in hold than what that research is indicating. Upwards of 40% over the last 10 years in the increase in slot hold.
Right.
The equivalent of raising the price of your product.
Right.
40%.
The operators, it's just 1%, but it's really more than 1%.
Yes, correct.
You have to look at it really as a percent of the total percentage hold.
Right.
So if you have a 10% hold and gain, which is tight as it is, if you increase that by 2 percentage points, you're actually increasing the price by 20%.
Right.
But I think what's also important is actually after I wrote that article for GGB, mm-hmm. actually a couple clients called me up and said, Steve, great article, but you didn't discuss was how much also the average bet has increased. Mm-hmm. You know, so historically in the gaming industry, the higher denomination machine,
right,
the lower the hold percent mm-hmm. was. So logically, when pennies come around, well, pennies should therefore have the highest hold.
Right.
But a penny game's not a penny game.
Not a penny game. Right.
You know, yeah. So when you have the average bet of $1.50, $1.75,
right,
and you look historically when an average bet, say, for a quarter game was 75 cents, well, if the average bet is now twice what it once was, automatically that's going to be half the time of device.
Right.
Now, couple that with a much tighter machine.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is you have that much less time on device,
right,
and it's impacting the customer experience.
Yeah, and customers are staying away because of that, because they don't get the time on device.
It's not
they
much
don't, they don't get the enjoyment, the entertainment that they used to get.
Yep.
And they're certainly willing to lose that money, but you know, give me some time, you know, playing the machine anyway.
Yeah, when we first started moving toward these multi-line video reel machines, about 1999, 2000, when Aristocrats start to introduce these games to the market. Now, prior to that, we had three reel steppers and four reel steppers. And there was a certain amount of volatility in those machines. You know, you could sit down on a dollar stepper, put a $100 bill in, and not get anything back over $100 in coin in.
Right.
So what the multi-line video reels allowed a game manufacturer to do was reduce the volatility. So you wager, you know, $5 and get back $4. You wager $5, get back $5.25, and the tug of war,
right,
which kept the customer interested, extended the time it took for a machine to make a decision, and it allowed you to have, you know, fewer pulls per minute.
Right.
Then things started to change.
Right.
And we started to increase the bets, mm-hmm, forcing people to bet $4, $4.50,
right,
$5 for a max bet on a penny game.
Right.
And people's money started evaporating much quicker.
Right.
Now, all of a sudden, they kind of woke up and said, it's just not fun anymore.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, and you know, now couple that with the fact that, you know, they're not winning as much as they once did.
Right.
And just look at the IRS forms. They can mm-hmm. see they don't have as many forms,
right,
as they once were. But also couple that with, you know, for a gamer, the casino is their social experience.
Right.
You know, the employees are their friends.
Mm-hmm.
And when the recession occurred in 2008, casinos understandably had to figure out where to cut costs, so they cut a lot of labor.
Right.
You know, so they cut labor down, still able to service the machines, but very often that slot technician also acts as the slot ambassador,
mm-hmm,
and they're friends with the players.
Right.
So now that the players aren't winning as much, their buddies aren't around as much, so the experience just isn't there, so they find someplace else to spend their discretionary income.
Okay. Right. I don't want to come back to slots in a minute, but I want to go to your other area of expertise, which is in the international markets. You have an office over in Thailand now.
We actually have we have two offices now. We have an office in Bangkok that I divide my time between here in Las Vegas, and Bill Bryson opened our office in Taipei.
Okay.
Beginning of the year, so
right
now we have four locations.
Okay. Bill, give us some of your background so that the listeners understand your you know where you're coming from.
Well, I've been lived in Taiwan since 1988,
okay,
so I've been 27 years there, working for two American law firms,
mm-hmm,
one for 10 years, one for 17 years.
Okay.
I've been working with the gaming industry since 1990 out in Asia,
mm-hmm,
and that's involved a lot of advice on corporate issues,
mm-hmm,
marketing restrictions, foreign exchange restrictions,
sure,
which are very important for people who have customers,
right,
mm-hmm, out in Asia. I've done research for those clients in 52 different countries,
mm-hmm,
giving them advice in all those countries. Primarily focused, though, on Taiwan, China, Hong Kong, that
mm-hmm
part of
okay
East Asia, as well as Singapore. I've also done work for clients on internet gaming,
mm-hmm,
particularly advising them on internet gaming restrictions
right
in different jurisdictions in
mm-hmm
Asia. So
okay
my practice has been primarily Asia-based.
Great. Let's talk about some of the jurisdictions you have clients in. I know you're working with a couple of clients in Vietnam. What's going on there? You know, there's been talk over the last year that they're going to allow, you know, locals to gamble there. Is there any legs to that?
You know, I think in Vietnam, you know, we are going to see a different directive come out to allow an expansion of some sort in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
There have been rumors before of, you know, minimum $4 billion investment. I think they're over that.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's going to be an expansion of gaming, more reasonable size casinos, and,
mm-hmm,
and the government wants to see people willing to put forth capital and have a long-term strategy.
Right.
I don't see locals being allowed in the first wave.
Yeah.
Does it happen in the second or third wave? I don't know, but
mm-hmm
but right now, that doesn't seem to be the the hot topic. Bill, I don't know if you have any more insights in that.
For Vietnam, no, I think you're right. And when the decree comes out, I don't think we're realistically expecting them to allow nationals.
Well, $4 billion sounds like a lot of money. You know, is that feasible over there?
No. For your first point, $4 billion is a lot of money.
Yeah, and it's not feasible.
And it's not feasible. It's certainly not. There are very few markets in the entire world where a $4 billion casino is feasible, much less in an emerging economy like Vietnam.
And I think, too, you know, the only way a $4 billion investment could potentially be feasible, which is definitely not, would be if you had a guarantee for the ability to take over take over junkets like we're going to Macau 2 years ago.
Okay.
You know, we don't see that happening. And it's not exactly like China and Vietnam have had the tightest relations over the past couple decades. You know, and it's also, I think it's wrong for a government to dictate the minimum spend you need on a resort. You have to allow the markets to define how much they're willing to spend on a resort, not try to tell them how much they have to spend.
How about Russia? I know you were active there for a while. This in October, the first casino will open in the Vladivostok area. Is that going to be successful?
You know, it's a tough one. I mean, it opened.
Yeah.
It opened pretty recently, a couple of days ago,
yeah.
I believe.
Okay.
You know, they're not hitting their marks. The problem was, in my opinion, they don't have enough hotel rooms. Mm-hmm. I still think there's a market there.
Right.
You know, you still have northern China, who has long-term relationships with Vladivostok and Primorsky Krai. But Tiger de Cristal, I think, opened up with 120 hotel rooms.
Mm-hmm.
So being that's 45 minutes away from the city, which has hardly any hotel rooms,
right.
You know, you have to rely on just those 120 hotel rooms or an 8-hour bus trip to Harbin, China, you know, to get people back and forth.
Right.
So that's... it's tough to make that pencil out. You need a larger critical mass.
Right.
I think, you know, Chinese and Russian relations are pretty strong.
Mm-hmm.
I think that market can still definitely be successful.
Yeah.
But you've got to build a proper facility to have them come, and a proper facility involves a proper number of hotel rooms.
Okay. Well, we've also seen the Chinese government react to junkets to casino destinations pretty negatively recently.
Sure.
And obviously, anything you build in Asia is going to depend at least partially on the Chinese market. Do you see them loosening that up anytime soon? And this is also related to what's happening in Macau, I guess.
Bill?
Oh. Yeah.
I'm laughing because the common wisdom, because we've seen crackdowns in the PRC before. We saw crackdown 10, 12 years ago on marketing offices, and we saw a crackdown a few years, you know, around the same time on PRC Chinese being able to cross borders to go gambling. That crackdown lasted about 6 or 7 months. It wasn't even aimed at Macau. It was actually aimed at illegal North Korean casinos across from Harbin, actually, and these other border areas where people were going across the border in North Korea. They're dropping their money there and coming back to their villages poor, and that's what it was all about. This crackdown, though, has actually shown some legs, because it's actually a three-legged crackdown. The first crackdown was on government corruption, and so you know, government officials stopped coming because they don't want anybody questioning where their wealth is coming from. Second was on conspicuous consumption.
Right.
Which isn't just directed at gambling.
Yeah.
It's directed at everybody having big wedding parties
and
everything else, but it redounds on to not being at the VIP table at a casino in Macau.
Mm-hmm.
And now the third leg is the crackdown on people who market to Chinese to go gamble.
Right.
And that's the most recent leg.
Mm-hmm.
Which the fact that they've added that third leg within the last the last 2 months indicates to me that this is going on for a while, and the Xi and the Xi Jinping is serious about keeping it going for a while, at least until he feels he's rooted out all the corruption that he's trying to root out, and he's accomplished his purposes. But this is not looking like it's ending soon. All crackdowns eventually end, but it's not clear when this one will.
Okay. Now in South Korea, they are doing a RFP for four casinos.
Yes.
In different regions of the country. I know Jeju Island is exempt from that for some reason. But so what's your prediction on what's going to happen there?
You know, we've had many clients ask us look around there, and this could potentially fall in the same category as how many multi-billion dollar integrated resorts can Asia sustain, particularly given the crackdown in China.
Right.
Now, we know definitely part of that revenue being lost in Macau is going to other jurisdictions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we definitely see other areas benefiting.
Right.
I don't know if I would want to build a multi-billion dollar resort whose success is contingent on the junket market out of China.
Basically one sub-market in one country.
Yeah.
It's a very dangerous proposition. Now, if Korea decides to move forward and allow its residents to gamble, which my understanding they're not going to at this time, these projects become very risky endeavors.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have, what, 32 gaming companies looking at Korea right now, applying for these these four licenses? Not that great a story at the end of the day.
Yeah.
You're almost at a point where the casinos are going to be forced to go back to the old customer bases,
right.
the pre-Chinese customer bases,
right.
which were Japan,
mm-hmm.
Taiwan,
right.
Korea, Philippines, yeah. Singapore, Southeast Asia, and then perhaps West Coast, U.S. West Coast based Asians,
right.
Asian Americans, and those were the old client bases. I mean, the
right.
Taiwanese customers used to produce more revenue for Las Vegas than everybody else in Asia combined,
yeah.
And now they're completely dwarfed by Chinese customers, but I think it's going to actually force the casinos to take a second look at, you know, to go back and look at those old bases that they probably, by and large, neglected.
Right.
Because the Chinese customer base has been so huge. But I think they're going to have to go back to that.
But I think it's important to note, though, that being said, the Asia gaming market is still extremely robust.
It's huge.
That's going to be my next question.
You know, you still have, you know, 300 million plus middle class in China, and while they are going to enter a recession, they will get through it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, trying to predict what Chinese policy is going to dictate is very difficult.
Right.
But you have, as China goes in recession, you have other surrounding economies who could potentially benefit from increased manufacturing. That's
sure.
going to be good.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still very pro gaming in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Let's hope that eventually passes. You have a huge population there that alone can make up for some significant gaming dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So gaming in Asia is not going anywhere. It's
no.
only going to grow. It might just, you know, flatten out the macro for a little bit, but it's still a great place to be if you're an operator.
I did an interview yesterday with Mike Bolsover from Silver Heritage. They have a bunch of small casinos
sure.
you know, in Nepal now. I just ran into to Tim McNally from NagaCorp. He said, you know, they're going completely the opposite way that Macau's going. He said they're getting some of that spillover
right.
business.
Exactly.
So there's a healthy industry there. It's just what size it is and how spread out it's going to be, I guess, is the question.
There are a lot of opportunities, particularly with Silver Heritage.
Mm-hmm.
You're not mega properties.
Right.
But you have good, you know, reasonably sized properties in border communities and in regional markets that service still a sizable population.
Mm-hmm.
Nepal services 1.3 billion people in
yeah.
India.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty big population.
Yeah,
we know there's a lot of poverty there.
Right. Yeah.
But in 1.3 billion, you're going to have a lot of people there with
right.
the means to gamble.
Yeah. Yeah, no question.
Even as 2%, yes.
Yes, that's exactly. It's a real market.
All right, so we talked about, you know, the two issues that I know you do very well. Tell us what some of the other things that your company does.
You know, a lot of our other stuff has a focus with, you know, advising clients strategically
mm-hmm.
as they go into new markets, helping them understand cultures and how to best integrate into that. And then we do a lot of, actually, and Andrew did some in Singapore as well, some more operations analyses and kind of teaching and just helping customers give an outside view of how to help them make more money,
mm-hmm.
basically, at the end of the day.
And one of our core businesses remains marketing analysis
yeah.
mm-hmm. And feasibility analysis. But marketing analysis remains an integral part of our business, where we'll go in and analyze a casino's marketing spend.
Mm-hmm.
And try to get an understanding of what their rate of play reinvestment is.
Okay.
How much they're spending. And, you know, and over the last 10 years, this has become a more important issue as we moved away from traditional rewards such as cash back to this thing called free play,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, as we migrated to free play, an interesting thing occurred where we removed the thing called cash to customers or cash back or direct mail offers redeemed for cash. We moved it off the income statement and replaced it with the thing called free play, which in many jurisdictions doesn't even appear on the income
right.
statement. It is deducted from gross slot revenue.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, this very large marketing expense has vanished.
Right.
But they're still there.
Much to the chagrin of marketing directors who feel they have more money to spend, but it's still there.
Yeah.
And so we try to go in and look at it and tell the casino operator, you know, what the true spend, player reinvestment spend is.
And I tell you what's really interesting, when you look at casinos' databases, and particularly as player reinvestment has gone up so much over the past 5 years as everyone's fighting for market share,
right,
is when you really get into their databases, they are upside down at a large, very often upside down at a large percent of their customers. Mm-hmm. And it's hard, understandably, for an operator to say, we are willing to purge these customers. I'm not saying just the winners. I'm saying people, right, because of reinvestment, they're upside down. It's tough for them to say, we are going to purge these players because our revenue is going to go down, which it will.
Right.
But their EBITDA will go up, which is true.
Right.
And another thing that we see a lot, which is tough, is that so many operators only reward customers based on theoretical versus actual. Mm-hmm. And then when you pull their theoretical numbers, they'll be 20% off from their actual. Mm-hmm. It should never be off by more than 0.5%. Right. But for some reason, the system's set wrong. Mm-hmm. So now if their theoretical is 20% higher and they're rewarding customers only on theoretical, their player reinvestment is actually 20% higher than they want it to be.
Right.
So that's, it's interesting how you see that with a lot of, you know, good, well-known, respected operators.
Yeah.
So we try to help them that as well.
Yeah, we've seen very inordinately high player reinvestment rates, even amongst the smartest, most successful casino operators in the world. Well, they'll go in and have customers that have theoreticals of $1 million, but their actuals never seem to approach that number. Mm-hmm. And once you start factoring in show-up money, discounts on loss, promotional allowances, and all the other things that we give these customers, shopping spree money, and that they're upside down lot of customers.
Yeah. Due to poor settings, they're basing their reinvestment on a percent of money that they already gave to the customer.
Right.
So
it's kind of like counting it twice, I guess.
Exactly.
So the things we continue, those are areas that we continue to work on.
Okay. And we're also working on project development, gaming development projects. We've looked at them in Taiwan, Korea, right, Japan, mm-hmm, Vietnam. So if we're retained by an operator, mm-hmm, we can take them through the RFP process,
right,
through the contracting process, all the way to financial close.
Mm-hmm.
We can do that. We also do some public advocacy work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, trying to if you know, obviously you have to get in at the right time, but we've helped governments understand industry's concerns, mm-hmm, when they're an
sure,
emerging gaming jurisdiction,
right,
that's looking to draft a new law, pass, mm-hmm, a new law. We've helped them understand the industry's concerns.
Right.
Review the stat, review the law, give comments on it, mm-hmm, that'll you know, still meet their regulatory needs,
right,
but also meet the practical needs of the operators who are, okay, going to be bidding for the licenses.
Okay, great. Let's get into this situation. We were here at G2E. GGB's editor, Frank Legato, is hosting a session this afternoon on skill games, and this seems to be the big, you know, savior of the industry right now, and of course we know we've seen many of those come and go. What's your opinion on the skill games, which is, you know, the regulations that have been approved now in Nevada?
I think skill games are important for the growing millennial group.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, though, you know, those aren't the ones who are creating profit today.
Right.
I think they're very important for the long term strategically.
Right.
It's how the mind thinks today. I think skill games will eventually be successful. It'll take time.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's going to have a similar impact, just like server-based gaming was going to 5 years ago.
Okay. So I was talking to a friend of mine the other day who's my age, you know, and how come they're not marketing to me? You know, I've still got 20 years left here. Is the industry ignoring, you know, this baby boomers now in favor of millennials?
I don't think so. I think the fact is, what you need to have in order to be an avid gamer, an avid gambler, you need two things. You need time and money.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're a millennial, when you're 32 years old,
right,
you really don't have either.
Mm-hmm.
You're working, you're saving, you're getting married,
right,
you're going to bars, you know, whatever, all the things, mm-hmm, that people do when they're 30. But they don't have time and money.
Right.
Lo and behold, I'm 50 and over, you know, you're now an empty nester, suddenly you have some, mm-hmm, money,
right,
and maybe you're scaling back and working, you have time. Gaming becomes a pretty good entertainment option.
Right.
You know, that hasn't changed.
Right.
You know, to this day, you know,
hasn't changed for generations.
Hasn't changed for generations. Right. You know, I recall working in Laughlin back in 1994 and looking at these customers, and, you know, these customers, everyone's saying these customers are going to die off.
What happens when they die off?
What happens when they die off? I went back there early this summer, 20 years later, and I saw essentially the same customer. not the same people, but the same kind of customer. Right. Mm-hmm. So whoever was 45 years ago, right. 20 years ago, they're 65 today, mm-hmm. and they find Laughlin
right.
as a value gaming destination pretty appealing. Mm-hmm. So
is it a bit overblown, the fear that millennials aren't going to follow their fathers and grandfathers and into this pattern?
That providing we can give them a quality product, which mm-hmm. our industry needs to get back to providing,
right.
They will gamble when they're empty nesters and have time and money.
Right. And the fact that they're already coming to casinos to go to the clubs and have yep. bottle service, that's got to be a positive right there.
I think it
you've
is
already, you've already got them coming to your place.
They like the entertainment experience. Yep. Yeah. They like the room product. They mm-hmm. like the pools. They right. like the eye candy, all the things that you get by mm-hmm. coming to casinos. And they will continue to come back. Their spend may shift from nightclubs to table games right. and slots.
Great. But what has been good is, you know, part of it forced because of the recession, part of it just to any evolution of an industry, we have diversified. So we do offer those things now, such as, you know, nightclubs and shopping and, you right. know, a quality entertainment experience. So the group that is attracted should become bigger than it was 10 years ago,
okay.
just providing we give them that quality gaming product as well.
Well, guys, thanks for getting together. I got the opportunity to get you all in one place at the same time. That doesn't happen very often, but it's nice to see you, and congratulations on the success you made waking the industry up to this payback percentage problem.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Roger.
Thanks, Roger.
Thanks for joining us on the GGB podcast. If you want to read more about this issue or any issue in the gaming industry, read our magazine, GGB Magazine, or visit ggbmagazine.com. For weekly updates on the gaming industry, subscribe to GGB News. For more information, visit ggbnews.com. I hope you enjoyed the interview, and we'll see you next week on the Global Gaming Business Podcast.